Hello, sex fans, and welcome back. Today is Monday, September 26th, 2011, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge, with your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick. That's me. I have a special announcement. Today's program marks a milestone. This is my 300th podcast. I know. Can you stand it? We've come a long way since I timidly began this audio educational and enrichment effort back on February 12th, 2007. In the interim, I've launched 4 interview series. The Play With It series, the Sex Education series, the Sex Wisdom series, all of which appear on Wednesdays, and the Erotic Mind series, which shares Monday with my traditional Q&A format, like today's show. Today I'll feature some questions from the Sexually Worrisome, a delightful sexual enrichment tutorial, and some heartfelt thoughts on my work as a sex therapist. But before we get to that, we have a word from our sponsor. This week's special show is once again brought to you by DrDickSexAdvice.com and DrDickSexToyReviews.com. That's right, sex fans, our sponsor today is me. You'll have to excuse this shameless self-promotion, but I wanted to call your attention to a standing invitation for everyone in my audience to help support and underwrite these marvelous shows. I am exceptionally proud of the quality programming I've been bringing you, my international audience. For the last 4.5 years, I've presented a variety of extraordinarily informative, enriching, and entertaining shows. Interesting interviews, enlightening Q&A, and even some fun product reviews. I mean, where else can you find this sort of diverse sex-positive programming? And all of this always comes to you absolutely free. Okay, so right about now you're probably asking yourself, hey, Dr. Dick, how can I help support and underwrite this effort? Well, I'll tell you. You just mosey on over to either one of my sites, DrDickSexAdvice.com or DrDickSexToyReviews.com, and look for the Donate button. It's a blue, heart-shaped icon. Click on it and make your contributions. Any amount will do, but those folks donating $50 or more will receive a swell thank you gift, excellent personal lubes, smutty porn DVDs, wonderful sex toys, or some delicious erotica. Be the first one on your block to join me in bringing the world this fun, informative, and enlightening programming. And now I'm processing donations via PayPal, so it's even easier than before to make your contribution. Okay, let's mosey on over to the email inbox and see what we have. We have Edward, who's 81, and he writes from New York. Does a prostatectomy pretty well kill the pleasure of being fucked in the ass? Well, Edward, I don't know if I'd say kill all the pleasure, but it certainly would considerably alter your anal and rectal sensitivity. And this will depend on the type of prostatectomy that you're talking about, either radical or the less invasive variety. The radical kind not only removes one's prostate, seminal vesicles, and tips of one's vas deferens, it may also remove the surrounding fat, nerves, pelvic lymph nodes, and blood vessels. In other words, things would certainly not be as they used to be down there. Many of the men I know who have had this type of surgery report that they don't have the same sensations in their ass that they once had. And sensation is not just for pleasure. Sensation will also alert us if we are injuring ourselves. After radical prostatectomy, men experience dry orgasms in which there is no ejaculation. There are 2 reasons for this. One, the two structures most responsible for the fluid in our jizz, the prostate and seminal vesicles, have been removed. The vas deferens, the tube that transports sperm from our testicles, has also been shut down. The muscle that closes the bladder, allowing a guy's spunk to move out of his cock rather than into his bladder, is compromised. So instead of shooting out what is left of his spooge, his ejaculate becomes retrograde and empties into his bladder. A dry orgasm doesn't necessarily affect a guy's desire for sex or his arousal, but many men do report they feel less confident as a lover without the familiar and very pleasurable ejaculation. Luckily, as we all know, an ejaculation and an orgasm are not the one and the same thing. A guy can have a very pleasurable orgasm without an ejaculation. Most men also notice a significant change in their erections post-surgery. This is also complicated if there is radiation therapy after surgery. Sometimes it can take over a year after the surgery for things to get back to an semblance of normalcy. I know that's a little off topic, but I thought I'd mention it anyway for those in my audience less familiar with this type of surgery and its aftermath. I've had several doctors tell me that a radical prostatectomy doesn't affect the anus or rectum. They go on to say that once the patient gets over the pain associated with the surgery and the incision fully heals, he will be able to have anal sex without restriction. While I wholeheartedly applaud their plucky optimism, I always have the same response. I'll bet you're not a big old bottom, huh? No avid butt pirate would ever make such claims. Because a good part of being a bottom in ass fucking is the joy of having a cock or a strap-on massage our prostate and all the nerve-ending rich areas surrounding our prostate. When that's gone, even though one is fully healed and capable, once again, of taking it up the ass, anal sex will never be the same. Besides, there's often muscle damage in the area that will also complicate things. Good luck. Now, here's an exchange I had with a fellow named Jim. He writes, "Dear Dr. Dick, I've been following you on Twitter for about 6 months now, and I have really learned quite a bit. To be honest, I have been really turned off and or bothered by expressions of homosexual behavior by men for a really long time, ever since that I can remember, actually. However, a few months ago, my wife and I were watching porn and were surprised by a gay scene. We fast-forwarded through it, but it weighed on my mind. Fortunately, my wife of 17 years and I have a very open communication policy, so I discussed my curiosity with her. She was open to watching the full movie again to see how I felt. I liked it a lot. Then we decided to have a go at some of the stuff we saw. I liked that too, a lot. So last night we tried some more stuff and then discussed the whole issue very openly. As an aside, I am blessed to have such an open-minded and accepting wife. Anyway, she has always expressed an interest in trying out her own same-sex encounter, but we've really never been able to figure out if it would be a good thing for our relationship. So last night we discussed the option of attempting to link up with another like-minded couple and see what happens. We are both worried about messing up a really good marriage. We agreed that the other couple must not be people that we are going to see much more of, if at all. We are concerned about bad feelings cropping up. The flip side of that is that by inviting a non-well-known couple to our bed, we are inviting STDs. We left the discussion open without any decisions being made one way or another. So, I thought of you this morning, and I figured I'd ask. Should we just shut this down now and continue to play at home while fantasizing, which seems like the safest route? Or should we embark on this path? I know you cannot give specific advice, not knowing us, but does the kind of experimentation that we're talking about tend to tear people apart or bring them closer together? Any thoughts you have would be most appreciated. And don't worry, I hereby waive any and all blame for anything that happens and fully understand that our choice is ours and you bear zero responsibility for anything at all. We're just looking for your thoughts. Thank you very much, Jim. Well, Jim, thanks for letting me off the hook there. That's the beauty part of free advice. You can take it or leave it. Anyhow, it's interesting to me that you've had such a virulent reaction to same-sex behaviors. Do you know why that is? Is there something in your background or your sex history that triggers this response? It sounds to me like you have a great marriage. Congratulations to both you and your wife. So you report that after you found the gumption to watch the whole porn movie again, including the gay scene, you liked it a whole lot. What accounts for your change in attitude? Something must be going on, right? Are you just allowing your mind to be opened a bit? You say that the movie sparked an interest in trying more stuff. I'm curious, what kind of stuff? Could you be more specific? I'm delighted to learn that this whole sexual awakening you are experiencing has led you and your wife to consider possibly opening your relationship to include the option of hooking up with another like-minded couple to see what happens. Again, good on you guys. I commend you for breaking open the discussion. It must be very exhilarating for you both. Your concerns that you might mess up an already good marriage, I suppose that possibility always exists. However, I have to say that your marriage sounds like it could withstand some stretching. I mean, you guys are just discussing an experiment, not a shift in lifestyle, at least not yet, right? I understand your concerns for anonymity regarding potential play partners. One's first forays into uncharted sexual territory can be scary enough without having to worry about making a lasting connection with the couple that you're about to play with. But, as you suggest, inviting strangers to your bed might increase the possibility of picking up an STD. But, surely, you will all practice safe sex, right? That would cut down on the likelihood of any STIs, right? To your question about the safety of keeping this open relationship idea a fantasy, all I can say is fantasy is indeed nice and safe. And while experimentation is more challenging, the rewards are much greater too. Just remember, an experiment is just that, an experiment. If it doesn't work out, it's no big deal, but you will have challenged each other and pushed through your fears, which is an achievement all in its own. My experience is that most, if not all, couples grow through experimentation. Just keep the lines of communication open, okay? Good luck. You know, this exchange with Jim got me to thinking it was about time to revisit a tutorial I did a little while ago about open relationships. I've been hearing lots from people lately who are considering opening their relationship to include affectional and/or sexual partners to augment their primary relationship. People point to the increasing media attention swinging and polyamory are getting as a way of justifying their interest. It's true. These relationship models are enjoying an efflorescence in the popular culture these days. This suggests to me that there is a fissure at the foundation of the dominant relationship model, the monogamous heterosexual reproductive pair. All the sociological underpinnings of why our culture promotes this paradigm aside, I think it's undeniable there is a level of dissatisfaction on the part of many who initially bought into this model as the only way to live, love, and raise children. But is it? People may feel trapped in the traditional expressions of committed relationship, but while they may be second-guessing the party line, they are equally wary of throwing open the doors of a relationship in a haphazard sort of way, and rightfully so. For starters, the viability of an open relationship depends on maturity level of the people who are considering opening their sexually exclusive relationship, and how much they are willing to work at communicating with one another through all the little details that such a decision entails. And I'm willing to go on record here to say that the devil is indeed in the details. That being said, there are a few things us sex researchers know for sure. In most cultures, people claim to practice sexual exclusivity, which is commonly referred to as monogamy. Although I think that's a misnomer, because monogamy literally means having one union, which, as we all know, tells us nothing about the sexual expression either or both partners are having. Lifetime sexual exclusivity, being sexually involved with only one person for one's entire life, is very rare. Serial sexual exclusivity, having a series of exclusive relationships over one's life, is more common. And despite knowing that we humans do not mate for life, we continue to presume that sexual exclusivity or monogamy is the only legitimate kind of coupling. This unfortunately leads to our culture's obsession with cheating, that is, having sex with someone outside of a sexually exclusive relationship. Yet, what I know about humans, human relationships, and human sexuality, I can say for certain that fidelity is not necessarily a genital issue. One can indeed be faithful to someone else and still have the freedom to express him or herself sexually with others. It happens all the time. In these cases, the fidelity is to the relationship and to the agreements, parameters, and boundaries mutually agreed upon by the partners, not genital exclusivity, which gets me back to my opening comment about the need for communication. Of course, it's much easier to presume that everyone in a relationship is working under the same rubric, but that kind of presumption is a fool's paradise. Another shortcoming of setting up sexual exclusivity or monogamy as the only legitimate kind of coupling is that it diminishes all the other types of relationships that flourish, albeit in a more covert sort of way. And here I'm talking about an array of open relationship models and polyamory. The fact that we're only now hearing about these non-traditional relationships shouldn't suggest to anyone that they don't exist, or that they aren't practical alternatives to the traditional monogamous model, or they are not practiced by a lot of people. They do, and they are. It just means that most people in non-traditional relationships know not to go public in society. That would shame them for their lifestyle choices. Open relationships and polyamorous relationships work because people in them adhere to some basic tenets about how to conduct themselves. First among them is the notion that these alternative relationships must be chosen. They cannot be mandated. If one or another of these persons is considering an open relationship or poly relationship, is being pressured into going with the flow, or is fearful that he or she will be alone if he or she doesn't comply with the will of the others, that kind of thing is emotional duress and will not work. Each person in a relationship needs to take responsibility for the choices he or she is making. And if you're not up for the task, or that this kind of arrangement is not compatible with your personality type, don't attempt to override that. You will only jeopardize the relationship for the others involved. However, if the idea appeals to you, give it your best shot. I can guarantee it that you will be learning something about yourself and the other people involved. Just remember that exploring something and having it carved in stone are two very different things. Second, communication is key. The more complex the relationship structure, the greater need for open lines of communication. Know your boundaries and express them clearly. Ask questions. Never assume that you know something when you don't. Third, know yourself. You must be able to deal with your emotions, particularly jealousy, in an upfront adult sort of way. This is often much easier said than done. If you need to be the center of attention just so that you can feel good about yourself, or you have serious territorial issues, this is mine, and this is mine, and this is mine, alternative relationships are probably not for you. You should also know what keeps you even keel in terms of what you need and what you are able to give. There has got to be a healthy tension between these two things. If you're the kind who gives too much and resents not being rewarded for your gifts, stay away from alternative relationships. Or if you are so needy that you can't stand it when someone else is enjoying his or her time in the sun, open or poly relationships are decidedly not for you. You should also know that alternative relationships of whatever stripe are, for the most part, on the fringes of what society will accept, and some are outright taboo. This doesn't mean that you will have to slug it out on your own in a vacuum of support. On the contrary, you will no doubt find that the people who are living contrary to the expectations of the popular culture are often a whole lot more generous with their support and compassion than those who are following all the rules. You will find that your support system will shift from the more traditional sources like family, church, and community to alternative sources like clubs and social groupings of the kind of like-minded individuals as yourself. A common mistake made by those in non-traditional relationships is to take their problems and issues to traditional support systems. This rarely works because the traditional support system will inevitably blame the non-traditional relationship setup for the problem. This is not true, of course, but how would those in traditional relationships know otherwise? I always suggest that those in non-traditional relationships bring their issues to non-traditional support systems. There you will less likely to find judgments about your life choices and more likely to find help with overcoming the problems at hand. Good luck. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about my work as a sex therapist. You know, I'm surprised at how few people have any sense of what we sex therapists actually do. While I can't speak for all of my fellow therapists, I can tell you a bit about my own practice. Most of the work that I do is cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. It is short-term, goal-directed, and personally liberating. I don't believe this kind of therapy should become a lifestyle. Basically, I suggest that people with sexual issues change the behaviors that contribute to their problems as a surefire way of solving them. I try to give my clients all the tools that they need to be successful in working things out on their own once the therapeutic intervention is over. This approach doesn't fit everyone. However, 99.9% of the people I work with respond positively. I encourage my clients to give themselves permission to investigate their sexuality. This, in turn, assists them in taking charge of making themselves feel better and/or perform better. And as soon as they do, they almost immediately have greater sense of well-being. Like they say, nothing breeds success like success. You know, once we identify an area of concern, my client and I create a plan of action for them to implement. I believe the more that the individual is part of his or her own healing process, the more productive that process will be. Sadly, I find that fewer and fewer people are willing to give their sexual issues the attention they deserve. Rather than invest investing the time and energy to get to the bottom of their issues, they may opt instead for the quick fix, the give me a pill for that mentality. They're often unwilling to make the necessary lifestyle changes to actually solve their problems. For example, I encounter people who are eating themselves to death, or abusing alcohol, or drugs. Of course, they have the accompanying sexual response issues, erection problems for men and arousal concerns for women, and they may desperately want to resolve these issues, but without committing to any change in behavior, i.e., I want my erection back, but I don't want to stop drinking. Such interventions almost always end in disappointment. Sexual dysfunction of one sort or another is an issue I see most recurrent in my practice, although the reason why a client reaches out varies. Sometimes an individual's tolerance level peaks, and they finally decide to do something about the issue that may have been smoldering for years. Sometimes it's a partner who brings in their proverbially broken partner telling me to fix them. Couples often seek sex therapy together, as sexual problems tend to be more obvious in relationships. However, by the time a couple comes for therapy, the issues have most likely been plaguing them for some time. The relationship often comes close to ending before the couple agrees to address the problem. For example, say a guy brings his wife in because she's frigid, whatever that may mean. They have been married for X number of years, and he's finally had it. She, on the other hand, doesn't want to be in therapy because she doesn't really think there's anything wrong with her. She just doesn't want to have sex anymore, and she doesn't want to discuss it, period. This is a difficult way to start therapy, needless to say. Resentments are high and frustrations rage, and if the couple does continue, we usually discover that there is something desperately wrong with the husband. Inevitably, we ascertain that he is an ineffectual lover, and his inability to pleasure his wife is the root of her problem, in quotes. It's awful. Often painfully clear that he knows very little, if anything, about his wife's sexual needs or wants, and meanwhile the wife has never had the permission to know her body, so she's unable to help or direct him. As you can see, in this case, there is a load of remedial sex education that must come before anything else is resolved. Now, couples also seek therapy when one spouse has cheated on the other. The cheated on partner declares in no uncertain terms that the therapy is a last ditch effort before the end of the road. Often in such cases it's way too late for any successful intervention because each of the partners is so angry and so shamed that the chance of turning the situation around is slim. Sometimes the best we can do is to end the relationship with as little acrimony as possible. In difficult couple counseling situations like this, my first effort is to get the couple to disarm. There will be no sex therapy, and God knows there is a need for sex therapy until there is some semblance of peace between the partners. If we don't establish at least a small bank of goodwill, our efforts are doomed. Of course, there are plenty of individuals and couples who haven't waited until the last minute to seek help. These people want to be proactive about their concerns. Some people simply need some clear, unambiguous information about human sexuality. A surprising number of people are trying to piece together their sexual lives, but are hampered by misconceptions and misinformation. Sometimes a traumatic event motivates a person to address arising sexual or intimacy issues. A disease process, a death in the family, or an accident can fundamentally alter the power dynamic in a relationship, which will require a rethinking of the entire relationship. Or perhaps someone comes to a new realization about him or herself. Perhaps they are finally able to acknowledge their bisexuality, or that he's gay, or that she's lesbian. Maybe they are finally able to acknowledge a fetish. He's a cross-dresser, or she's into some other kink. Things like this obviously impact the individual, but that person is in a relationship, and the relationship is also affected. People in these self-revelatory situations are often unsure how to talk about the discoveries with their partner, which is another reason why they seek counseling. Now, some couples don't fret when the sex vanishes from their relationship. Other couples are devastated. What does one do when one's partner still has sexual needs, but the other doesn't? Often there's an unexplored option that can hold the relationship together, but will address the disparity of the sexual interest and desire. In this case, I can help the couple make compromises without losing their moral compass. Some couples navigate this with ease, others not so much. It can be extremely challenging, but there is always ways to preserve what's sacred about a primary relationship while contemplating opening that relationship to include others. I can help a couple establish guidelines, ground rules for making the necessary adjustments. Sometimes the relationship is really wonderful and fun, and the couple really loves each other, but they notice that their sex life is pretty boring. I'm often approached to simply help couples spice things up, and in this instance, my work is a sheer joy. Mostly, I just give them permission to experiment and have fun. You've probably noticed that a good portion of the work that I do as a sex therapist is merely giving permission. That may not sound like therapy at all, but when you consider that our sex-negative culture is so full of prohibitions, permission-giving is often the front line of sexual rehabilitation. Most of the permissions I give are for individuals to educate him or herself about his or her body and his or her sexual response. Personal exploration, such as masturbation, is the very best means to educate. I'm a huge proponent of partners masturbating together. Happily, our need to reacquaint and re-educate ourselves about our body and our sexual response cycle is a lifelong process. There is always something new to explore. As we age, our bodies change, and if we don't keep up with those changes, we can become frustrated and disoriented. Older people, menopausal women and andropausal men, take longer to build up a head of sexual steam, so to speak. If you're not attuned to the changes you are going through, you can easily miss the important cues your body is sending to slow down and enjoy the sensuality. Of course, I could go on, but now I want to leave you with what is the distillation of years of my thinking about the role sexuality plays in our life. I believe that sex is like food. We can enjoy it alone or with others. We can be abstemious or gluttonous. We can nosh or nibble, dine or devour, and we can be certain there will be both times of feast and famine. Sex is like food. It can nourish and sustain us, or it can make us sick. We can consume all of the available bounty or restrict our diet. It can completely satisfy or leave us devastatingly empty. We can employ it to express our highest aspirations or allow it to rob us of our soul. We can give it as a gift or use it as a weapon. It can be both bacchanal and sacrament. One thing for sure, whether purely physical or transcendentally spiritual, no one can live without food or sex. Good luck. Well, that's it for today, sex fans. Tune in this coming Wednesday, September 28th, for part two of my conversation with transgendered author Tony Newman and more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's special 200th podcast is sponsored by Dr. Dick's Sex Advice and Dr. Dick's Sex Toy Reviews. Folks, I need your help to continue to provide shows like the one we just heard. But you may be asking yourself, hey, why should I make a donation? Well, I'll tell you. Infrastructure and administrative costs for a free site like this are astronomical. So if you like what you see and hear, if you enjoy all the wonderful features of DrDicksSexAdvice.com and DrDicksSexToyReviews.com, then I invite you to make a modest one-time donation online. We suggest a donation between $20 and $50, but any amount will be gladly accepted. This is a one-time donation. There are no automatic credit card renewals or processing fees. And you can be certain that every dime you donate will go to support this valuable sex-positive effort. Finally, your donation underscores your social conscience. Your sponsorship helps disseminate badly needed sex education and sexual enrichment messages throughout the entire world. I thank you in advance for your generosity. Until next time, remember, sex is good, and good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.